It's 5 o'clock, and you are listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. And before we begin, we always say the views that are contained in this hour may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. So it is 5 o'clock, and as always at 5 o'clock on Tuesdays, we turn to office hour. This is Professor J, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and we're going to go out and we're going to knock. We're going to knock on someone's door, and we're going to find out all the things that are going on in this campus. What are people doing in these buildings? What are they thinking about? What ideas are they bringing forward? If you're a student, you might hear a faculty member on the show, somebody you might then decide you want to take a class with. If you're part of the larger community, you get an idea of some of the arguments and interests that faculty have on campus. And so we go to from department to department. And today I'm very pleased to go to a department we have many friends of in the Department of History. And today we're talking with Beverly Bosler. So welcome to the show, Beverly.
Thank you for having me.
And Beverly is a specialist in what we call late medieval or early modern Chinese society. So we have a lot of interesting things to talk about, including the role of poetry in that society. But as always, before we begin discussing her particular area of research, one of my interests is how people become the professors they become on campus. And I think that's something that interests my students as well. So we're going to ask Beverly, how does it happen that a nice girl growing up in Buffalo, New York, becomes a specialist in medieval Chinese material? It just seems like you've gone very far from Buffalo.
Yeah, I think that's true. Is that working? I guess, well, it's even more complicated than that because I had a whole life as a ballet dancer before I even went into academia, but that's another story.
Okay, we'll have to come back to this sometime. Beverly Bosler as a ballet dancer. This is something, you know, when you do these interviews, you learn new things about people. So that I bet is quite an interesting story. So we're imagining you dancing. And then
I decided I wasn't going to dance and I needed to go back to college. And I was hanging out with some folks in New York who were doing linguistics. And one friend of a friend was doing Chinese linguistics. And I thought, oh, that would be a very cool thing to do.
Just sort of randomly?
I had always liked languages. And I just thought, oh yeah, Chinese, that would be interesting. Mm-hmm. And so when I finally got to, well, I did a year of engineering.
Engineering.
I did. And then I ended up going to college and deciding that I wanted to start studying Chinese so that I could do linguistics originally. Mm-hmm. But the more I studied the language, the more I became interested in Chinese for its own sake. And I was also doing my sophomore year, a graduate course in transformative grammar, and it was boring. And sorry, folks. I mean, transformational grammar was...
It wasn't
my thing. And so I ended up deciding to major in Chinese studies or East Asian studies, as it was in the department where I was. And mm-hmm. So I studied Chinese language, and I had to take other courses in Chinese history, Chinese literature, and I became very interested in particularly in the Song period, which is the period of a very new kind of Chinese philosophy that sort of resonated with me. That's Neo-Confucianism. I think that'll come mm-hmm. up later probably as well. And decided that I just wanted to study the Song and study the mm-hmm. history of that period.
No, I imagine it's somewhat daunting to take up a language as complicated as Chinese. I don't know if you have anything to say to our listeners about what it's like to embark on the study of a very rich and tremendous literary tradition, but one that actually involves a pretty big commitment to. It's not like you know, working in some of the languages that are closer to English.
Right. Well, it's interesting. Chinese is difficult, especially for Americans, for two main reasons. One is that it's written in characters rather than letters, or ideographs right. rather than letters. So learning to be literate is really a huge challenge of memorization. There's just no way around it. You just have to memorize lots and lots and lots of characters, and that just takes time and work. The other thing that can be challenging is that Chinese is a tonal language. Mm-hmm. And so ma, 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 ma are all different words. They mean different things. And if you can't hear those differences, it's very hard to learn to speak Chinese well. If you have a musical ear, then you have an advantage. Hmm. And I was lucky. I grew up in a household with a lot of music. And so that the tones were not as challenging for me as for some people.
Mm-hmm. And so besides, you know, being drawn to Chinese language in general, you said you were very early drawn to a particular period.
Right.
And I think
right.
that's very interesting that you are looking at what is it about the Neo-Confucian that was so appealing to you?
Well, Neo-Confucianism really grew out of Buddhist influence on Confucian culture.
Okay.
And it rejected the ideas of Buddhism that involve going off and being by yourself and being withdrawing from society. It rejected the idea that life is an illusion. Mm-hmm. Confucianism and Neo-Confucianism are both very much believing in the here and now, and that actually this is what's important. This world, your relationships with other people, this is what matters in human life.
Mm-hmm.
But like the Buddhists, they decided that the way you could come to truly appreciate that was through meditation, through self-cultivation, through understanding how the mind works, from looking at the ways anger and other emotions entrap the mind. So they absorbed a lot of Buddhist ideas into Confucian practice and called it, well, they never called it Neo-Confucianism. They said this is what Confucianism
right,
always
exactly.
did.
Right.
But we call it Neo-Confucianism in recognition of that. And I had in my ballet and other days done a little bit of floating around with mind work of various types, Gurdjieff and stuff like that. And so the Neo-Confucian in that sense of self-cultivation appealed to me.
Mm-hmm. So just to clarify, you know, Confucianism is very this worldly, right?
Yes.
We think of it as being a lot about family,
absolutely,
society structures, following rules. Mm-hmm. But maybe one of the amazing things about Buddhism is that many, many people can pick things out of Buddhism.
You know,
you can put Buddhism through a lot of different kind of meat grinders in different cultures and use it in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite striking because it's used in very different ways in different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're saying is there were parts of it that might have seemed to conflict with the very this worldly bureaucratic family structure of Confucianism. Mm-hmm. So those they just ignored, but they took from it sort of some of the techniques, would you say, ritual techniques, for example, meditation as a technique?
Well, it was more an act of rejection than ignoring, in the sense that precisely because they were absorbing those techniques, but because those techniques were so close to Buddhism, they had to be very, very clear, no, what we're doing is not Buddhism.
Right. Mm-hmm.
No, those Buddhists, they're terrible. They fool society. They get people to carry out rituals that are not proper, but Confucianism just happens to now have, which it had not had before,
things that look very Buddhist,
something that we call quiet sitting,
mm.
that looks from an outsider very much like meditation, but no, it's not meditation.
Yeah.
That would be Buddhist. It's quiet sitting.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a terrific example. It's like you put on the front of your house, no Buddhists allowed, but you open up the back door and you bring in a lot of Buddhist ideas.
Right.
So then we end up with this period, the Song Dynasty, which I guess runs about 960 to 1279.
That's right.
Our listeners' idea of what we're talking about. And you're interested in a particular Yan Mian.
Yao Mian. Oh, this is
terrible pronunciation. You're my Chinese pronunciation. who is one of the sort of, we think of the literati. Now, mm-hmm. I think it, maybe we need to describe a little bit for listeners what this figure is. He's kind of unlike any figure that I think many of us are used to, because he's a combination of both being a poet and a bureaucrat, from what I can see, or at least a wannabe bureaucrat. Mm-hmm. Maybe he never quite got where he wanted to be, but he was part of the exam system.
Well, in that sense, he's like every other elite male in Song society.
In China, right?
In China at that time, if you were a member of the elite, you were educated to try to be in bureaucratic service. But one of the things that happens in the Song is the population is increasing, and the examination system, printing is coming in, education is expanding, so you end up having way more people who would like to be bureaucrats than the bureaucratic system can absorb.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a lot of educated people running around who would aspire to be a bureaucrat, but they basically have to find other things to do. But from the beginning, I mean, even prior to the Song, even in earlier periods, the idea that the ideal bureaucrat was also skilled in poetry, was highly literate, those things all went together from very, very early in Chinese culture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there's nothing odd about Yao Mian in the idea that he's a poet and also a bureaucrat. Everybody is supposed
right.
to be. It's unusual how good a poet he is. Well, actually, in some ways, he's almost less known for his poetry than for his parallel prose, which he was really good at, which was a kind of almost poetic prose style that had a kind of cadence to it,
mm-hmm.
And was highly elusive and extremely difficult to master, and he mm-hmm. was very good at that.
Well, that really points out a difference, because I don't think of bureaucrats in our culture as being very poetic, but maybe it turns out that they do write poetry. They're just not ready to share it. So now what you end up having is that something of his collected works.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, so you end up having a giant corpus, and I imagine that most of this material you work with has never been translated into English. So
that's
you're in a pretty obscure field here now, just because there's probably a lot of Chinese literature from this time period that's mm-hmm. not available in English.
That's right. There are probably upwards of 1,000 collected works that survive from the Song period by, you know, all of these different bureaucrats whose dutiful sons, after they died, collected all their writings and had them printed. And because printing was expanding, we've got them. So compared to medieval Europe, we have a huge source base. But as medieval studies colleagues from Europe have pointed out to me, it's a completely curated source base. So you can't just wander into a church and find documents that happen to survive in the Chinese case. If it survived from the Song, it's usually because it was printed.
Right, and somebody printed it.
Right.
So somebody collected all of his material together. And one of the fascinating things about him is that he interacts, as you describe, with lots of different kinds of characters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you get a glimpse of a range of social roles mm-hmm. That he wrote about. And in particular, you are interested in his interaction with soothsayers.
Mm-hmm.
They're, again, another interesting social role.
Mm-hmm.
People, astrologers, and physiognomists, people mm-hmm. who were predicting the future based on facial characteristics of people?
Right. They predict your likelihood, for example, of passing the examinations or being successful in the bureaucracy on the basis of your facial structure.
Right. So, and I saw here he interacted with 22 different soothsayers. That's quite a...
Well, that he wrote to.
You think he interacted with even more than that?
Quite likely. Yeah.
So I'm just trying to get a picture. Is he going around trying to get a good prediction? In hopes, is that one reason why he deals with so many, or would he just have many different times in his life when he would be checking in with soothsayers, or what? How can we give an idea to the listeners of how this interaction happens between the literati and his soothsayer?
Well, first of all, he's taking the exams every 3 years.
Every 3 years.
For over a decade before he finally passes. So actually, almost two decades before.
So 20 years of taking tests.
Right. And so every 3 years he makes, and it's a 3-year process, essentially. You take the local exams, you pass that, then you can go and take the exams at the center. Sometimes he doesn't even pass the local exams. But each time he would go into an exam, he would want to get his fortune told ahead of time.
Mm.
And soothsayers, I mean, it was a way of making a living, especially if you were one of those educated people who couldn't find a job as a bureaucrat. That was something. You were literate. You could write, tell someone's fortune, or at least some of them were literate.
Mm-hmm. So he has, and you describe him as being ambivalent about soothsayers. And I think that's an interesting point, that you can even read it in his collective writings, that part of him wants to have this idea that you just take tests. Mm. And part of him seems to be drawn to this sort of more irrational relationship with his bureaucratic life, which is, I just want to know what's going to happen to me.
Right,
you know,
right.
I mean, it's not like he didn't study as well. So we find this ambivalence. And do you think that's sort of typical of the literati, that they had this kind of ambivalent relationship with, between bureaucracy and then sort of, you know, prophetic predictions?
Well, I think in general there was a desire to tell the future, and that, I mean, it fascinates people even now. How many people read their astrology column, right?
Right.
However seriously you may or may not take it. And there was probably less reason then than now to reject astrology, although... Even young men at times says, oh, you can't believe a word these guys say.
Yes.
They'll promise you anything. And in fact, he writes one of his really interesting pieces is where he writes to someone. He writes to a soothsayer who has actually correctly predicted that he would pass the exams. But he had met this soothsayer at a previous occasion.
Mm.
When the soothsayer said, no, you won't pass this time. And he was really disgusted with him because he told him he wouldn't pass.
Mm-hmm.
So he thinks, he says, well, maybe this is true. But he wrote him a poem that first time, and the soothsayer's lost it. And he says, well, if you really believed in me, you would have hung on to that poem.
Mm-hmm.
And so, can I believe in you or not? Because if you really knew that I had a good future, you would have held on to my poem, because it could be valuable after I become a famous literatus.
Right. But, so the soothsayer doesn't even believe in his own predictions.
Right.
Right. Exactly. I'm curious. I think about things like rabbinic dream interpretation, where mm-hmm. the idea is that the interpretation that the dream interpreter mm-hmm. gives to the rabbi is very important and kind of shapes the future.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any idea here that the soothsayer has any impact on it, or is he simply a vessel for learning something that he really has nothing to do with? He has no actual impact, and his interactions with literati have no impact on the world per se.
Yeah, I think my understanding of it, and I'm not by no means a sort of expert in the occult arts of the Song, really, but my understanding is that there is not a sense that the soothsayer has any control over the future, but merely that he can read it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So then we meet Yao Mian writing poetry, and you have a lot of interesting comments about why he wrote poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, presumably, there are more than one reason for writing poetry, because you talk about poetry as having so many roles in society.
Right.
So some of them, there may have been different reasons, but you do mention one which I think is more unusual, which is the idea that he wrote poetry in order to pay for the soothsayer's mm-hmm. services, which mm-hmm. is, again, not a model we have in our society.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a nice one, the idea you write a poem and you leave it as a, you know, in place of a tip or something like this.
Well, it only works if you're going to be famous enough that piece of poetry you wrote
has
could actually have value. So you can imagine Picasso dashing off a little picture to pay somebody for his meal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody knows it's... And so it worked rather like that, but that was predicated on Yao Mian becoming a famous official.
Right.
And after he does, he actually, when he finally passes the exams, he takes first place, which is huge. That means you're really destined for a stellar career in the highest echelons of the bureaucracy. Doesn't work out for Yao Mian for a number of reasons, but at least at that moment, he looked like he was a star.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, people would want his poetry because and he would be able to pay people in that
His form. Poetry value went up a lot when he came in very strongly at that moment. So how much do you think that he saw the bureaucracy and the taking, that all these 30 years of taking tests, do you think he saw them as being a rational endeavor, or do you think there was some feeling like students feel sometimes around testing, that there's a kind of an arbitrariness and that it's hard to know what to study and that the system doesn't really work?
Right.
You know, it's a very carefully built up Confucian system. You think of it as being sort of examples we often hold up of the most rational kind of examination system. But I got the sense reading this that even the most seemingly, rational system had kind of irrational and arbitrary moments or aspects to it for the people who were part of it.
Well, it's a little bit like the Chinese examination system even still today,
Is
that there are just so many people taking the exams and so few places. People have compared your chances of passing the exams in the late Song with your chances of winning the lottery.
Wow.
So it was like a lottery. You had to be good, but there were so many people who were good that to be selected was difficult. And so, yes, I think absolutely that he felt that you needed the help of the stars. You needed the help of
anything you could get.
Right.
Anything you could get. To come back to your idea of your interest in Neo-Confucian ideology, you also talk about how Neo-Confucian ideology sort of becomes more ubiquitous throughout the system and thought, and it even influences the examination culture. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that. It seems, again, very opposed, the kinds of things we think of how do moral issues and moral purity relate to questions of examinations?
Well, the real question is, how does morality relate to government? And in the Chinese theories of government, a good emperor was one who was a moral person, who hired as his bureaucrats moral people who would govern in moral ways, and then heaven would be happy because everybody was being moral, and the people would be happy because they wouldn't be exploited by immoral bureaucrats, and the system would all work very nicely. So the assumption was, first of all, that being highly educated, that's why exams mattered. You wanted educated people because educated people are more moral. I mean, this is a connection that's often made in Europe as well, right? Or in the
European system. I'm not sure it's
true. A claim. Yes, and it was only a claim in the Chinese case as well. But the idea was you had to have this kind of moral backbone to your bureaucrats, so you wanted them to be well-versed in Confucianism. Now, what happens with Neo-Confucianism? Neo-Confucian ideas get bruited about in the early part of the Song Dynasty in the 11th century, and they become more popular very, very gradually over the course of the 12th century. And then in the early 13th century, the government decides to make Neo-Confucian texts the basis for the examinations. So all of a sudden, everybody wants to learn Neo-Confucianism or has to act like they believe in Neo-Confucianism
just to make it
to
get
pass
ahead.
The exams. And Yao Mian himself, I think, and part of the reason we have his surviving collected works is because he did have some claim to being Neo-Confucian. But in fact, if you read his stuff, he sends letters to people who have known Neo-Confucian sympathies, and they're full of Neo-Confucian terms, and he sounds like he's completely one of them. And he writes to everybody else without any of that rhetoric. And I think he's using it completely instrumentally.
So he's only a Neo-Confucian when needed.
Exactly.
This guy was had a lot of techniques at getting ahead. You know, might be he can do a primer for our students on all the different strategies that he used to get ahead in a heavy examination culture. I just want to reiterate that he didn't. They don't use the word Neo-Confucian. They just saw themselves. They did not see the difference between their ideas and what they saw as traditional Confucianism as really being important.
Well, yes and no, because the people who were promulgating what we call Neo-Confucianism, they had their own, there were some names for what they were doing, and other people saw them as changing Confucianism in ways that weren't necessarily helpful.
So there was Confucian debates and
there were absolutely
controversies.
And the Confucians used, the Neo-Confucians used a set vocabulary. It always reminded me when, remember when structuralism and post-structuralism was a big thing? And and they say you can, those Neo-Confucians, they're a clique and they're getting their friends into the examinations by telling, by using these secret terms. And you can tell that, and so there was a lot of... there was a lot of debate about it. And in fact, Neo-Confucianism, or Daoxue, as it was called, the study of the Dao, was actually proscripted for a while in the toward the very end of the 12th century. It was called heterodox learning and was actually illegal for a while.
Mm-hmm. And that's fairly familiar from any tradition that we know that spans so many generations that there are going to be reformations and all of those kinds of things are going to happen as well. Well, this is terrific. We have come to the end of our first segment on Office Hour today, and we're going to take a break, and then we will be back in the second half with Beverly Bosler from the Department of History. And we will be talking about courtesans, which I think is a topic of great interest to many of us. So just stay with us, and we will be back in just a minute. So we are back. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and we are back for the second half of Office Hour today. And we are talking with Beverly Bosler from the History Department here on campus, and we're talking about Song Dynasty, that's 10th through the 13th century Chinese culture. And the first part we talked about poetry, and in the second part we're talking about those enigmatic figures known as courtesans. So one of the things right away I think we see when we start to talk about your material on courtesans is that there's lots of different types of figures that are just sort of generally clumped together in our English word courtesans, which isn't very good, even though the other words may be less good even than courtesan. So maybe you can take us a little bit around the vocabulary from the 10th and 11th and 12th century to these women and how we can differentiate what their social roles were.
Mm-hmm. Well, the words that I'm translating as courtesan is essentially female entertainer.
So it's female entertainer generally. That's the G term.
Right. It's funny that the term G in modern Chinese has come to mean prostitute, but that's not what it meant in the Tang Dynasty or the Song Dynasty when these women were entertainers for Chinese literati or elite men. Remember, you've got a society where wives, good wives, noble wives, elite wives are not seen in public.
Okay.
They're basically cloistered.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, if you're a bureaucrat and you want to have a party to send someone off, they're about to leave to go to a new appointment, you have to have a party to send them off. Well, it's rather dull if it's just men, right? So you need to have entertainers, but women who you can't have your wives because that would be shocking and inappropriate. And so they're developed in response to this need, if you want to call it a need, this women whose services were either for sale or in some cases, we now know they had government courtesans. So the government actually kept women as more or less government slaves, indentured servants, if you will, to the government, whose job it was to entertain at banquets of officials.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they sang. They were often extremely highly trained in different musical arts, in singing and playing different instruments, and in dancing. But they also did what was called urging the wine cup, which is to say, you know, here, drink some more, have some more to drink, and making conversation, flirtatious conversation, and just generally keeping the party lively.
Okay, so let's try to differentiate these different social roles. As you said, on the one hand, there's the wife.
Mm-hmm.
And in most of these cases, there's only one wife. Was that true in Song Dynasty?
There's one legal wife.
One legal wife.
However, a man this is where it gets complicated and interesting. In the Tang Dynasty and prior to that time, so prior to the 10th century, more or less, a man in Chinese society could have more than one woman, only one wife, but he could have other women in his household that were sexually available to him based on his status. The emperor has a whole bunch. He's got a whole harem, right? But
so how many might that be, what's the top of the system?
Well, again, the top of the system is the imperial court, where the emperor might have 1,000 women.
I have 1,000 women.
But according to the numbers, official numbers, like a very high official was only supposed to have 10 concubines. So a woman who's in your house, she's a kind of a consort. She's not a legal wife, but she's a partner, and she can have children, and her children will be legitimate.
They are legitimate.
They are.
So what's the difference with being a legal wife?
You are all the other wives have to wait on you.
Uh-huh.
The concubines have to wait on you. And actually, the legitimacy question, there's some change over time, too. So there's definitely stigma for the children of concubines up until the Song Dynasty, and that starts to change in the
Song. So it's safer to be the child of the head wife, of the real legally
Right. You have a better chance of getting ahead and being well-treated in the family.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a wife and you can have concubines. One of the things that happens in the Song is they don't restrict the number of concubines the way earlier dynasties had. So basically, in the Song, as long as you have money, you can have as many concubines as you want.
As you can afford.
As you can afford.
Mm-hmm.
And that just blows the whole system wide open. And I argue, actually, that that's one of the things the Neo-Confucians are responding to, is this drastic change in the family system made by the fact that now many, many families, ordinary families, not just the highest elite, has concubines in their household. And that means they have children of concubines, and that just complicates family relationships.
I bet.
All over
but
the place.
What is the Neo-Confucian attitude towards all of these concubines?
Well, because in Confucianism, you want to have lots of sons. So they say, yes, you want to have lots of sons, and so you want to have lots of concubines. And the wife should not be jealous of these concubines, because they're producing sons for her husband, and that's a good thing. And actually, technically, they're really her sons, because a concubine has no claim on her own children. They belong to the main wife. But at the same time, the Confucians, because of this Buddhist influence, the Neo-Confucians are very worried about desire. They don't want men to be overtaken by their desires.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is you can have as many concubines as you like, but you should not enjoy them.
And that's what they say, so don't enjoy them. But it's a complicated question because of the emphasis on sons. So I understand very much that there is a tension there between maybe having sons but not enjoying having the sons.
Right.
So I see that very built in there. Now, there are also other types of female figures that you mentioned. I don't know, the bondswoman. I don't know how a bondswoman fits in there after the wife and the concubine.
Well, yeah, the distinction between a concubine and a bondswoman is rather blurry, although technically, so a bondswoman would be essentially a slave, right?
A slave, okay.
But by the Song, or at least as the Song goes on, slavery, personal slavery drops out. In other words, the emperor, the court, the government can have slaves, but individuals are not supposed to have slaves. They have indentured servants.
Mm-hmm.
So a poor family might sell their daughter into a household for a 10-year period from when she's 7 to when she's 17. And so she's not a concubine. She's essentially an indentured servant in the family.
And she's not sexually available to have children, presumably?
Well, in theory, any woman in the household is available to the master.
Okay.
And so you do have situations where slave girls get a little older and become attractive, and then they can be made into a concubine.
Mm-hmm.
Technically, there's a little legal nicety that says, well, you can only, a concubine is supposed to be a free commoner. She's not supposed to be an indentured or bonded in any way. So the man is supposed to free her first and then get involved with her. But conveniently, you can free her after she's had children, if that suits you.
So speaking, I mean, convenience is a word that comes up quite a bit in these discussions. I don't know whether stepping back from it, you can try to help us make sense of this culture. I mean, on the one hand, you said that it was that the sort of given part was the seclusion of wives,
mm-hmm.
and that because of the seclusion of wives, you needed women to fill other roles.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, how do we know what is the chicken and what is the egg? And, you know, we seem to have sort of a division of female roles. It's like mm-hmm. sort of splitting up all the potential roles of women and sort of all the potential needs that mm-hmm. men would have and kind of allotting them among a mm-hmm. wide group of females
mm-hmm.
who all are quite, you know, have quite convenience of the male as mm-hmm. being sort of the center of the system.
Absolutely. Yes. Convenience of the male and continuity of the family are the two things that are at the center. I mean, some people would argue, well, the male is constrained, too, by the fact that he has to have children. I mean, he's supposed to be the father and he's supposed to bear children, and he has to be a good son. You have to have progeny for your parents.
So that could seem like it's very confining, but it doesn't seem quite as confining as the roles the women end up in on this.
Right. But to go back, I mean, to your first question. So the courtesans are outside the home. Courtesans are public women, if you mm-hmm. will. And they're available there. But there's a sort of a rule in the Song that officials are not supposed to be sexually involved with courtesans in their government offices. So they can party with them, but they're not supposed to have sexual relationships with
them.
And
what's the problem with that?
It's inconvenient for the men, right?
Okay, I was wondering.
The argument I make in the book I wrote on this topic is that precisely because they're not supposed to be involved with those courtesans, but they get used to the idea that women should be able to sing and dance and so forth, you start to get a fad for entertainer concubines.
Ah.
So now you want your concubine not to just come in and be attractive and wait on your wife, but you would like her to sing and dance. And when you have your male friends over, she can also entertain them as well.
Which a wife can't do.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have an idea why there is seclusion of wives? I mean, do you have a theory on that? It's found in many cultures, mm-hmm. but still I've never been totally convinced about the different things I've read in different cultures about. So I'm curious, now that you've worked so much and thought about these social mm-hmm. roles so for so long,
mm-hmm.
You know, it one can just say in a certain kind of simplistic way, it's a form of misogyny. But right. I'm curious as to why this particular form, the idea of the hidden woman or the woman who cannot be shown in public. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I do think it goes back to fear of women's sexuality. And as James Joyce once famously implied, you know, you the only one who knows who the real mother is the mother, right? And the father can never be sure, right? When you have a child, the maternity is clear. The paternity is never perfectly clear,
mm-hmm.
right? And that makes men nervous. Especially in elite cultures where you have elites and there's property to pass down, a man wants to make sure that all his property goes to his real sons. And locking up women is one way to try to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. I understand that. It's just interesting that that is true in many cultures,
right.
but cultures have different ways of trying to deal with
right,
it.
Right.
And seclusion is a very complicated mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. I mean, it often seems that it's a very elaborate kind of way to do that, and it ends up having, then you end up having to do so many other things, it just, it's not a simple solution to that. So I've often wondered how that worked out as a social system.
Right. Well, and there's also huge debates about what seclusion actually meant.
Mm.
If a woman goes out in a sedan chair attended by servants, she can be out traveling, she's still secluded. Mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, it didn't mean that women could never leave the house, for example. Chinese women went to parties at other women's houses and had fun and had parties. And
yes. Yeah, so probably the real point of the seclusion was that they were allowed to see other women. They might be allowed to travel. The problem was contact with other men.
That's right.
And that's what we're really talking about. We're really talking about a system in which women should be highly connected to only one male figure.
Exactly.
And that and it doesn't happen by chance. It's structured in a way. And that does make society very complicated. So then the question is, the emergence of the Neo-Confucian discourse, which you talked about a little bit in terms of desire, the Buddhist mm-hmm. ideas of desire. But was there anything in terms of morality? I mean, did it have, we also think of Neo-Confucianism as being related to sort of issues of morality.
Mm-hmm.
So how do all of these different kinds of service women relate to moral issues?
Well, again, the Neo-Confucians said that a man who is morally upright will not really be interested in playing around with women. He will do his duties with his wife as is appropriate, and perhaps with concubines and produce sons. But he's not to be distracted by the pleasures of listening to women sing and dance.
Yeah, no, you did mention that, but I'm quite striking that that's all that Neo-Confucianism has to say about morality.
Well,
is not to, you know, don't get too carried away in your propagation of your sons. Don't be, you know, don't fall into the Buddhist worries about desires.
Right.
It doesn't seem to have much more in terms of any other questions about sort of other things you think might fall into morality.
Well, the big puzzle for me when I was studying this is, why don't they go against courtesans?
Well,
why don't they want to get rid of courtesans? And they don't until, I mean, they basically say, even the one guy who is sort of the synthesizer of Neo-Confucianism in the Southern Song in the latter half of the dynasty, his name is Zhu Xi. And somebody even asks Zhu Xi, well, you know, what about these courtesans? And he says, well, everybody uses courtesans. What's the problem? Even he doesn't object to them. However, he does get very upset at the way that courtesans are subverting justice.
What do you mean?
Well, think of a local government office. The local magistrate gets very fond of one of the government courtesans who's there. Next thing you know, people are going to her with bribes and saying, you know, the magistrate's going to be ruling on a law case of mine, and could you just make sure that he knows my son is innocent? Or could, you know, and so there's a whole indictment of another official in which Zhu Xi claims that this official has had a relationship with this government courtesan and allowed her to obstruct justice by subverting him, essentially, and, you know, he's very, very exercised about that. But even then, he never says, well, we need to get rid of courtesans.
Mm-hmm.
Only a few decades later, after Zhu Xi, there are some people that are starting to say, you know, this is not a great system. We really should get rid of it.
Well,
but they don't.
When they start to have objections to courtesans, what is the basis on it? Is it what we could call proto-feminist? Or is,
no.
you know, so what is the basis then for not liking courtesans?
Well,
you know,
precisely because men will be men in government who should be moral and should be doing the right thing can be subverted by women.
So it's always the amazing capacity of female sexuality to be out of control.
Right. And to subvert men.
No matter what. Right. No matter how you control them as courtesans,
but
to make them into all of these different very highly defined social roles in which they're at a tremendous disadvantage.
Right.
And they still somehow manage to subvert the system for justice. So when these other Neo-Confucians don't really seem to be upset about courtesans, your argument is that it's just such a part of the cultural worldview there
mm-hmm.
that it would be hard to imagine, you know, just thinking about women in a different way.
Right.
And that ultimately that isn't really going to be what's going to change courtesans anyway. That you know, we're not going to find it. So you said that these words are still used in modern China now, that some of these words are used for prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the legacy then? When does the if you look ahead a little bit, you know, sort of like, where do we, how do we go from this world to, you know, into the more contemporary time with these same terms? And this question of how are you going to fit women into this social system? It's it's quite difficult to imagine changing the role of women without changing the entire social structure.
Right, which is kind of what the communists wanted to do and did do to a certain extent. I mean, it gets very, very complicated in the 19th and 20th centuries as Western ideas about sex come in, about hygiene, about the dangers of prostitution as a hygienic concern, a disease concern. And you have overlapping for a time still high class courtesans in Shanghai or 20th century, early 20th century Chinese cities. At the same time, you also have streetwalkers or lower level kinds of prostitution. But it becomes a kind of thing that you need to get rid of prostitution to be modern, or you have to be visiting prostitutes is not a modern thing to do. And that starts to change the attitude a little bit. I'm oversimplifying drastically here. But
no, but that makes a lot of sense. So if we go back then, we see the rise of more concubines in the time when there was just more sort of the breakdown of the rules. What would have been the equivalent for lower class who couldn't afford concubines? Was there what we would think of as lower class prostitution? Or since there wasn't really prostitution in that cultural sense, there was really this idea of access to other women in highly structured ways. Did that just mean that lower classes didn't have an equivalent to that? It was only something for the upper classes?
You know, we have no idea. I mean, basically, no one was in a peasant village. No one was writing about what they were doing for sex on the side, right? And we don't really have any records to be tell us what was happening. We do know there are references to low class courtesans or village courtesans who are kind of unfashionable and they're trying to be entertainers, but they really don't know how. They don't have good skills. They're sort of pathetic. They don't know how to put their makeup on right. But even then, those women, you can't imagine that they were there for the average farmer.
Right.
I would think in village, I have no idea. If you completely be ahistorical and read back from more modern times, a woman who was widowed and had no other means of support becomes available to other men in the village for a price, but I'm purely guessing.
Well, it's interesting that there are places where we just don't have the, in such a literate culture, there's big gaps in the in the literary traditions there. Now, what was the possibility? How high could a courtesan go? I imagine some of them, did some of them become really well-known poets? And figures of, even though they're trying to keep women down, there's, since men need women, there's often a way in which they end up with what we call inarticulate power and end up being quite powerful figures in their own right.
Empresses.
Right.
There were two Song empresses who entered the palace as female entertainers and then became favorites of the emperor and then became empresses, even though the officials were upset and said, no, you can't set aside your other empress in order to make this woman empress, because just like a regular man could only have one wife, the emperor could only have one empress. And then also just in literati households, a very clever concubine who then bears the heir. If the wife doesn't have sons and she does, and next thing you know, she's the mother of an official, and her filial son wants to get her an enfeoffment and give her a fancy title from the court because he's now a fancy official and he wants her to be honored too. So we have clear examples of that happening.
What about in terms of becoming literary figures, or was that really just not possible? Given this, the social structure,
we have There are one or two Tang Dynasty courtesans who left enough poetry and they have a sort of a name. From the Song, we have a couple of poems that were published and attributed to courtesans. We have lots of other women's, well, I shouldn't say lots. We have some other women's poetry, but not anyone famous enough to whose literary output has has survived.
Well, that's striking, given the fact that you have a thousand guys who left collected works.
Right,
I mean, that's a lot of stuff,
right?
And the women must have seen that as a model of a kind of success that they must have had you know, imagined that you know, given again the role of poetry as being so central to so many cultural roles.
Right. Where it's not entirely clear how literate the average courtesan was. Some are described as literate. Some are described as being able to come up with a poem in a, you know, just off the top of their heads, but whether that, whether they could write that poem or whether it was just oral is not entirely clear.
And in those women who could read and write, that was probably set them apart quite a bit. In other words, in sort of a general, female literacy was probably quite low, would you say?
I would say actually that among the elite, female literacy was not that low. Among the elite, we have evidence of a lot of women being quite literate.
And you make another very important point, which is that, you know, a man could choose his courtesan, but he couldn't choose his wife. So that might mean that there were certain kinds of relationships that were found only in the courtesan world in which people, just like, you know, people finding people who they actually were attracted to. Felt they had some relationship with. And that rarely happened within the wife structure because the wives were arranged marriages by and large.
Well, I wouldn't even say rarely. I mean, there's a fair amount of evidence that some that many arranged marriages, the couple was quite happy together. But you couldn't guarantee that. And there definitely were arranged marriages where the couple was not happy together. And you had to just tough it out. And yes, the man then had outlets. He could get a concubine. But the woman had no, you know. She could just devote herself to her children.
Right. So she was just stuck with the end of that story. I think your point on that is well taken. And I didn't want to say, because I've had many examples historically and also just called of arranged marriages. Nobody knows. They often work and our romantic ideas often don't end up doing not working. So I think that's a very complicated question. But do you it's quite striking to see, again, just the control of women. Do we find examples of women who are, was it just too dangerous, or do women have their own outlets that were sort of an underground version of the male having a wife, concubine, bondsman, you know, bondswoman? You had so much system there. Was there some capacity for women to manipulate and work their own way outside of the system? Or is this a kind of system in which the control of female sexuality is so central, as you were saying, to a system of genealogically important issues that it was quite confined?
Well, one point that some people have made, and of course, again, we have no evidence on how common or widespread this was, but women's relationships with other women were not problematic in this system because they didn't produce children. And so there's at least some hint, not from the Song, but from later imperial China, of women urging their husbands to get a concubine because they're interested in the concubine. There were certain possibilities. The other thing is, I mean, you're emphasizing the control of women, and I think that that's certainly, from our perspective, what strikes us. But I think it's also really important to be aware of how invested a woman who's raised in that system might be in the system.
Absolutely.
I mean, and the system definitely had rewards for women. The main wife has control over the children. A Chinese mother had a lot of power in the family. Men were off studying, so women had to run the households.
Mm-hmm. A lot of freedom
there. They were holding they were holding all the family finances in many cases.
Interesting.
So I try to get away from this image that, oh, the men, women are just sort of all cowering, being under control. It wasn't like that.
Well, we're getting near the end of the show, and I just wanted to know if you wanted to leave us with a thought question to think about and sort of like where you are now and what you're thinking about the role of women in Chinese society and all these different social roles. And, you know, a question maybe that's on your mind now. What are some of the thought questions you're thinking about based on all this research?
Well, I guess maybe I'd go back to what I just said, which is that there's a tendency that was exacerbated by the communist rhetoric of liberation. We have liberated all women. To look back at the Chinese past and say, oh, all those women were just pathetic. You know, they were just so downtrodden and so pathetic. When, in fact, if you sort of think about it, well, they weren't rebelling. I mean, they're to think about the kinds of rewards that the system gave those women, and to think about how we're all invested in a gender system in our own society. Mm. You know, how many women stand up and object to wearing high heels? Mm-hmm. Not too many. And, you know, why?
In 500 years, they'll be looking back and asking those questions just like we are asking them today. So
right.
Terrific. Well, thank you very much. It's Beverly Bosler from the Department of History here on campus. And you can listen to the show over again on OfficeHourUCDPodcast.com, OfficeHourUCDPodcast.com. And this show will be archived there. And there'll be a link to your website for people who want to see more and look at your out about your book. and there will be other shows they can listen as well. So thank you very much for coming on the show today.
It's been really fun. Thank you.
Yeah. And stay tuned now for Radio Theater. And we'll be back next week with a new interview with somebody else. We'll knock on another door. Bye.